I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Roxana Robinson. She's the author of 8 books, including the biography Georgia O'Keeffe, A Life. And this Thursday, the 15th of November, she will be giving a lecture titled O'Keeffe, Reading the Work as the Life, at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and it's part of the Georgia O'Keeffe 125th birthday celebration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
So, Georgia O'Keeffe, especially from our perspective here in New Mexico and Santa Fe, is often seen, I think, as an artist who's associated with nature and land and place. But she was doing very important work that a lot of people don't know about before she ever got here. She was one of the innovators in abstract art. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a very interesting question because she's most popularly known now, as you say, as somebody who did the flower paintings, who did the beautiful landscapes in Santa Fe. But she was also an early American modernist and part of a movement that started at the very beginning of the 20th century and was a movement in the art world that really responded to what was happening in Europe and the great early stirrings of abstraction. And so O'Keeffe was really interested in what was happening in Europe. She was in New York around 1908. She saw Alfred Stieglitz's galleries where he showed Matisse and Picasso and Rodin at a very early moment. So she broke loose from purely naturalistic representation very early on in her career. And so she, for the rest of her life, really, she swung back and forth between realism and abstraction in a way that was extremely fruitful. And her abstract work hasn't really been considered until recently as a separate body, and it's a very impressive one when you look at the whole corpus of those images. It's extraordinarily beautiful and very powerful.
I often wonder whether she, as one of the very first American abstractionists, hasn't really been given credit due as a lot of women innovators are not given credit due.
Well, it's true. She wasn't one of the earliest abstract painters. Most of her work, her very early work, well, no, that's not true. 1915, 1916, she was doing purely abstract pastels, and they were ravishing charcoals and drawings, and they were ravishing and very innovative. And Stieglitz did recognize that, and she was shown early on, and she was perceived as an artist that had a unique place. But then once she did the flower paintings later and the bones, those became sort of her signature, and people stopped looking at the abstract work. One of the interesting things that she did was, and the reason she isn't put into particular circles, she was certainly part of the Stieglitz circle, stable of artists, but her work doesn't look like anyone else's, so it's hard to group her in with another, with a well-known stable of artists. But one of the things that she did, which was so interesting and was completely unique to her, was to draw on the abstract nature of photography, which was moving in that direction in the teens. And she saw the work of Paul Strand, who made images from everyday objects, only made them into pure abstractions. It was very disconcerting and beautiful and extraordinarily innovative. And she used those techniques. She used magnification and cropping and vertiginous angles for her own work, but what he did was to strip the subject of emotion, and what she did was use it to infuse the subject with emotion. So her magnified flower pictures are part of a continuum with his magnified bowls, for example, which are shown in his photographs as something that's completely abstract. And they're wonderful, they're fascinating and beautiful, but you don't know what they are. O'Keeffe does the same thing using magnification and cropping with flowers, and you know exactly what the flowers are. So what she's doing is going for the essence of the subject and imbuing it with a tremendous sense of passion and emotion. So what she was doing was something that was right in the middle of the artistic flow and power that was taking place in America, but she used those things for her own purposes. So she doesn't seem to be part of another trend, but she was. She was part of these trends that were taking place aesthetically and intellectually, but she used them to create her very distinct and singular work.
It's interesting to talk about this because it brings up a lot of, I think, questions and interesting conversations, the kind that sometimes you have when you're in museums standing in front of paintings and photographs and things like that, of what's really the difference between real and abstract. Because, I mean, if you go in close enough, it becomes abstract. And the fact that I might recognize this as a flower, or somebody else sees it as an abstract shape, there's not really a clear boundary.
It's a really good point. And it's very hard for us today to imagine what it was like for the public in 1921 to look at those shapes, or in 1915, because we now are used to this blurring between abstraction and realism. But in the late 19th century, when realism was really the tyrannical force in painting, you know, it was almost photographic. You had to put in every single detail. And then suddenly, as the century turned, people started using this semi-abstract brushstroke that became very loose, and images became blurred. And the public was very resentful at the beginning. Initially, critics were furious. Remember when Turner did his beautiful paintings of fog and the Thames, that one of the critics said, "This is like having a pot of paint thrown in your face."
Right.
So we have become much more sophisticated, and we recognize things now as semi-realist, which were, when they were first produced, looked like abstractions.
We're talking to author Roxana Robinson about Georgia O'Keeffe. Now let's talk about Georgia O'Keeffe's relationship with Alfred Stieglitz, who, I guess, kind of discovered her and showed her work and was older than she, but they were also really equals. What was that relationship like?
It's a really, really interesting relationship. And throughout the history of art, women painters have had a difficult time for lots of reasons. Critics sometimes don't respond to them, or dealers don't, or the public doesn't recognize them. In the case of O'Keeffe, she was definitely discovered by Stieglitz. He was a really powerful presence in the art world. He was not only a photographer who championed the cause of photography and really insisted that it be accepted as an art form, so he was a vocal presence in the art world, but he was also a dealer and showed new and innovative work. And he was 23 years older than she was, and he was married when they first met. And he was very vocal and talkative and handsome and charismatic. So he was a tremendous force. Students used to come in, and when he first met him, he didn't remember this, but when she was a student at the Art Students League, her friends said one day, "Let's go over and listen to Stieglitz," because he would just talk at his gallery. He'd come out and just talk about art and hold forth. So he was a tremendously powerful figure. Interestingly, they first, he doesn't remember meeting her that when she came into the gallery, but the way he thought that he met her was through her work, and a friend of hers sent him drawings that she had done, and he saw the drawings and was transfixed by the beauty and the forcefulness and the female quality of them, and he famously said, "At last, a woman on paper." So he met her first through her work, and then when they finally did meet in person, she was living outside New York then, they fell in love. But she also responded to, they wrote to each other for quite a while and wrote very powerful letters to each other. So they connected on many levels, and they were both artists, they were both very powerful, they were both innovative, and they sort of cleaved together. He left his wife, they married in 1924. And they stayed together for the rest of his life, but it was a fiery relationship. And he had an affair with another woman quite publicly, which was devastating to O'Keeffe. And she had a nervous breakdown as a result of that. But they did manage to stay together. They decided that they had a great deal of connection, and they stayed together. He died in 1946, and she stayed with him and took care of him, and although she left to go in the summers to Santa Fe, but she really stayed as his wife for the rest of his life and loved him. But he was a champion of hers in the art world and insisted that people take her seriously. And for example, there was a show in Pennsylvania by a museum, and Stieglitz was asked to send works by his artists down there. But they told him, we don't want any women in this show. And he said, if you don't want any women, you can't have any of my artists. You only get my artists if you take O'Keeffe. So he took a very intransigent position on her work from the beginning. It was partly because he was in love with her. We have to acknowledge that. But it was also because she was a great, great painter. And I think without his incredibly powerful presence, she would not have received the kind of acclaim that she did. So it's a really interesting relationship, and I don't know of another one like it in the history of art. So she's definitely benefited from it, but on the emotional side, there were real drawbacks. She said at the end of her life, or closer to the end of her life, when there was a show of his work of photographs at the Metropolitan Museum, she said something like, you try to destroy each other. And it was a great comment to make. I mean, anyone who has a passionate relationship with anyone else understands what that means. And they did. And they also tried to invigorate and support and love each other and be the best partner that they could possibly be. So it was a very complicated, rich, interesting relationship.
A little while ago, we had Rob Krett on the air, who's the director of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and we're talking about this whole phenomenon of people making pilgrimages to the O'Keeffe Museum and to the places where she lived, and treating her as a kind of Lives of the Saints thing that happens with artists whom people admire. How has O'Keeffe, in your view, been not just a kind of icon, but a real positive role model for people?
I think one of the things that struck me, one of the key moments when I was writing the book, one of the things I learned about her, which resonated for me and maybe for a lot of women, when she was early, she was not a discovered artist. She was living in South Carolina and teaching, or maybe it was at University of Virginia Summer School. Anyway, she got up early one morning. She said she wanted to go up to the top of a hillside and see the dawn come from it. And so that meant she had to climb this mountainside in the dark. And she said the grass was wet, and the whole time I was walking, and it was dark, the whole time I was walking, I was afraid of snakes. And I was so struck by that, the fact that she knew she was going to be afraid the entire time, but what she was going to find at the end of it was worth it. And it seemed to me that was a metaphor for her career, that she was always afraid of breaking ground. It's always frightening to be an artist and to risk making mistakes and failing. And as an artist, as a courageous artist, you always run the risk of failing. And so there was always that sense of fear, but always a sense in her that it was worth the risk. Taking the risk, it was always worth it, because there was that sunrise at the top of the mountain that you were focused on. So I think O'Keeffe, for a lot of women, seemed to live a kind of life that accepted the idea of risk, took on things that were too much for her. Sometimes she did fail, but she never stopped going. She went up through the dark and the wet grass and the snakes, and she made it to the top of the mountain for the dawn.
That's a wonderful, wonderful metaphor. I'm going to remember that, because it's not about being fearless. It's about having fear and just doing it.
Exactly, because no one's fearless, and it's great to understand that someone you admire is afraid and goes on anyway.
Now, she lived a very long life. She outlived Stieglitz by, what, another half century or so. Did her courage and creativity and innovation continue throughout her life?
Well, to a certain extent. She died in 1986, I think. And she had macular degeneration, so she was, after a certain point in the early 70s, I think, she had no direct vision. She only had peripheral vision. And, you know, people's powers ebb. So she certainly kept on producing things throughout her life, really till very late in her life. I don't think she was as much of an innovator after, well, the 70s, maybe. But she had this tremendous outpouring of creativity. And most artists don't create many new things in their lives. There's usually one signature kind of work that they're known for. And O'Keeffe had a much longer arc than most artists. There are many things she's known for: the beautiful abstractions, the bones, the flowers, the red hills, the early watercolors. She really went through a huge range, the later cloud paintings. So I think there's a tremendous breadth that she accomplished. And she still was working in her late years, but not at the same level.
We're talking to Roxana Robinson, biographer of Georgia O'Keeffe, and I wondered what it's been like for you. I mean, this book came out over 20 years ago. The book is done, it's in print, and life goes on. Have you found new material or new insights or new thoughts? Is her life a kind of ongoing set of questions for you?
She certainly is a presence in my life. The other books I've written are works of fiction, short story collections and novels. But art is a big presence, I find, in my writing life. And often the characters in my books are involved in art in some way. One is an artist, one is an art historian, one is a photographer, partly because that's such an interesting world for me and partly because it's a world that I know. Writers always have to create spaces for their characters to live in, and John Cheever once said he was so jealous of men who went to offices because he had no idea what they did in them, and he needed settings for his characters. But I used to work in the art world, and I really enjoy that kind of intellectual questioning, and I'm interested by the questions that art historians and that artists and photographers have. So that those are places that I use for my characters to live. I haven't gone on writing about O'Keeffe just because it's such a huge field and there's so much new information. I thought I would either go crazy trying to keep up with it or I would set it aside. So she's a huge presence in my life, in my intellectual and writing life, but I haven't tried to stay up at the top of the material, knowing the material, just because it's I know so many other scholars have gotten involved with it.
Right, right. Now, how did you start in the first place? How did you become her biographer? How did you get into that work?
Well, I was working in the art world and writing. I started out working at Sotheby's, and I was in the American Painting Department, and that was my field. We did 19th and 20th century American art. So I worked on those artists. We sold a lot of work by O'Keeffe, and I started writing about those artists, and I wrote about Arthur Dove and Morrison Hartley and just became very interested in that group of artists. I met O'Keeffe. I met her agent, Doris Bree. So she was early on a subject that I was very interested in, and I went on elsewhere after Sotheby's and wrote more about that circle. And then after she died, I had already published another book, a novel, and a publisher knew I had written about art and asked if I would be interested in writing that book.
So you met O'Keeffe. What was she like, and what was it like for you meeting her?
I was already a groupie. I was already a tremendous admirer of her. I got a call from her agent, Doris Bree, asking if they could see a painting by O'Keeffe that we had at Sotheby's. So I went over to Miss Bree's apartment, and O'Keeffe was there, and it was a really interesting, sort of unsettling encounter, the way those things are when they're someone that you admire so enormously, you're sort of blinded by your own impression apart from the person themselves. And what struck me was, first of all, O'Keeffe was very short, which was a surprise, and she was wearing a house dress, if you remember, with a self belt, and she was wearing little black Chinese cotton slippers, and there were some lawyers in the room, and they were talking about the work. I forget what it was, why they were interested in it, but O'Keeffe was simply looking at the painting. She was paying no attention to anyone else talking. What they were talking about was serious and legal, and she was simply re-encountering the work, and it was as though she was looking at a child that she had not seen in years, and it was she simply stood and looked at the painting. It was very it wasn't impressive. It was a kind of one of those moments that you remember. There was a deep bond between her and the work.
Yeah. You are giving a lecture on Thursday, this Thursday, the 15th of November, titled O'Keeffe, Reading the Work as the Life at St. Francis Auditorium. What does that mean? Tell us about what you're going to be talking about.
Well, while I was writing the biography, my editor and I decided that we would not use color images as illustrations, and we wouldn't use a lot of paintings because there are so many books that have color illustrations, and this is a biography. So I wasn't allowed to have in my book the pictures that I wrote about, and I wrote about a lot of her work because it's obviously so important. So this is kind of an illustration of my biography, and what I did was go through the body of her work as though it's a visual biography, autobiography done by her, and that's really the way I see these particular works. Like many artists, O'Keeffe sort of painted her own autobiography, so it's possible to look at the work and see what was going on in her life and to read the work as this narrative of her life. So that's what I do. I show about 45 slides chronologically and talk about how these reflect her life, both her private life and her aesthetic life as an artist.
When you say that, illustrating her autobiography, it strikes me that I've never seen an O'Keeffe that has a person in it. Is that right? Did she ever paint a human being?
She did, very rarely. There's an early set of watercolors that she did in Texas of a friend of hers, and there are a couple of drawings of people, but no, you're right. She rarely did other humans. She rarely did living creatures. But that being said, she invests the images that she creates with so much emotion that it's very clear that she is delivering a personal message through the work. So that's what I am talking about. So I'll show an image and say this is what was going on in her life, and you can see from the image exactly how that's reflected there.
It was interesting for me when you said a moment ago that her work has so much emotion in it, those close-up flower pictures, for example, whereas the Paul Strand work was stripped of emotion. Is that a subjective judgment? I mean, how do you say that?
Well, when you look at the Paul Strand work, for example, it's a picture of white bowls, and they're sort of cupped against each other, and it's a very close-up picture, and you just see the rims and the shadows. It's a very abstract image, and it's black and white. And when you compare that to the famous image of the red poppy, for example, or the black iris, which show such sensitive. First of all, the textures themselves are very soft and fragile and vulnerable, and we all know that about flowers. We don't have to touch the canvas to know. We all have a very clear sense of what a flower is like, and the tissue itself is very fragile. Flowers have no way of protecting themselves. So we have this understanding that this is fragile material, very soft and vulnerable and tender, and the colors she uses are so powerful and so emotionally dramatic. And she said that herself once. She said, I go for the showy colors. That's what I like. So she deliberately chooses colors that have will create emotional responses in the viewer. She uses textures and the feeling of living tissue and membrane, things that make you have an emotional response. The way the red hills do, the soft red hills, which are, again, look tender and voluptuous and fluid. There's just a very powerful emotional drive that goes into her work, and I'll talk about it at length at the talk, but well, first of all, yes, everything is subjective. I mean, you can't write about art without being subjective. But I do think that between these very severe, austere, limited, formal images, black and white, that Paul Strand did, and the lush, tender, voluptuous, intimate pictures that O'Keeffe did. There's a huge emotional difference.
Roxana Robinson is the author of 8 books, including the biography Georgia O'Keeffe, A Life. And this Thursday at 6 o'clock, November 15th, she'll be giving a lecture titled O'Keeffe, Reading the Work as the Life. It's at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. And it's part of the Georgia O'Keeffe 125th birthday celebration. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the website is RoxanaRobinson.com.